welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And as promised, now time to switch our focus into the energy sector that has been quite exciting recently, with crude closing in on $80 a barrel as we're recording this on Wednesday, and natural gas up above $4. We are chatting again with Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Perspectives Group. We're going to cover what's driving the natural gas and oil prices, as well as get into a few companies, some that Dan has already introduced to us, and updating on some other ones. So Dan, let's start off with natural gas. That has been much more exciting, I guess we can say, since natural gas has really been going up throughout the fourth quarter of last year, and more or less continued that rise in January. Again, it's over $4. We all know that the weather has been a bit colder. Weather does impact the natural gas price quite a bit. But Dan, is that the only reason why natural gas is rising in your eyes?
Well, I think there was this belief that we were had this big glut of natural gas, which we did. At the end of last winter, we had over 700 BCF, more than the five-year average, in storage. So we had this surplus to work off. Well, as of today, that surplus is gone. As of the day we're recording this, it's probably back to the five-year average. That won't be reported until a week from tomorrow, but based on the storage draws I'm expecting, we're going to be below that. And then by the end of January, it now looks like we're going to be 100 BCF below the five-year average by the end of January. And the long-range weather forecasts that I get have this cold extending into February, at least the first week of February. But the next week, the week ending January 24th, I think the update that I got now, they're looking at a draw from storage of over 300 BCF for that week. So it's going to be, but that's not the only thing. It's LNG exports are quite a bit higher, setting new records every day almost, as Cheniere's Train 3 down at Corpus Christi is ramping up. Plaquemines is now ramped up to almost full capacity. And so we're exporting about 3 or 4 BCF per day more than we did a year ago in January. So at this time last year, the Freeport thing was shut down. The Freeport export facility was shut in, and now it's going full speed.
Well, Dan, I'm glad you brought in the LNG terminals, because that's been a big topic of discussion on our show and really out in the larger universe as far as nat gas prices. Obviously, the cold weather helps. There's always a seasonality and weather factor to nat gas, but these LNG terminals are really a more permanent thing that's going to be happening for years moving forward, not weather related. Do you think it gives the United States a slight edge over Canada in the sense that Canada doesn't have their export facilities built yet? They have 7 planned. There's one being constructed in British Columbia, but right now the U.S. has dibs on more export capacity. Does that give the U.S. an edge in the nat gas market to close the gap on the high prices you see in Europe or Asia?
Yeah, I believe now that the surplus from last year, because we had 2 mild winters in a row, we've worked off all that surplus now. So if we just have normal weather after January, we're going to be a very tight U.S. gas market. And we have pipeline export limitations out of Appalachia, which is our biggest supply of gas in the U.S. And we have pipeline limits out of the Permian Basin, which is also one of our big gas areas. So, you know, South Texas has ample pipeline. The Haynesville has some pipeline capacity left over, but pretty much that's about it. So it's like we can't just drill baby drill and increase production in Appalachia and the Permian Basin if there's no pipelines to hook it up to. So we're kind of restricted down here. And I believe we are facing a bidding war for supply that will be like what we saw in August of 2022. So any of your listeners, if you just go look at like a 5-year chart of natural gas prices, what you're going to see is in August of 2022, because of bidding war between the utilities and the LNG exporters for physical supply, the natural gas price went over $9. It didn't stay there for long, but it was a good 3 or 4 weeks where a lot of these companies could have locked in some really good prices. And then it did. And I really think that the period of gas below $3 is probably over. That was an extremely, uneconomic price for a lot of these guys. So, but if you look at a lot of these big gas producers at $4 gas, they are extremely profitable at $4 gas prices.
So, Dan, when these LNG terminals come online, what companies in the natural gas space are the ones in your eyes that will benefit the most from that?
Well, one of them at the top of the list is Antero Resources, which is symbol AR. And that is because they have got pipeline contracts that they can pump gas into what's called the tier one area of LNG exports, where they actually get a premium price for their gas. That they can get their gas down into southern Louisiana. If you go to their website and look at their reports, they show like a map of where gas prices are higher along the Gulf Coast. And they could get about 70% of their gas down there, I think. And I think they're getting 25, 30 cent premiums on their gas. That Plaquemines facility for venture capitals just opened up down there. It's a more than a 2 billion cubic feet a day export facility, and it needs gas supply. It needs steady gas supply to keep filling those, LNG tankers.
Well, Dan, you've also mentioned a couple other nat gas stocks to us in the past, and even some new ones that we haven't discussed. Do you want to cover any other nat gas stocks do you think give investors an edge right now?
Yeah, one I think, and I'm just mentioned, it's a smaller company, and it just doesn't get the Wall Street coverage that these other ones I'm going to tell you about do. It's Crescent Energy, symbol CRGY, and it is in South Texas. It's primarily an Eagle Ford company. They do have some Uinta Gas out of Utah that also has good pipeline access, I think. And on a BOE basis, about 70% of their production is natural gas. Now, they still get 70% of their revenues from oil sales, but that company has got a strong financial backer. They closed the merger with SilverBow Resources, and it's like the second highest producer in South Texas. I think EOG is the only producing company that produces more than they do. It just doesn't get the coverage it should, and it's going to get a real nice revenue boost from these higher gas prices. And it does have access to the Gulf Coast, where it can get, NYMEX like prices. It can get like the $3.50 to $4 gas price. Where in the Permian, the one thing, if you're just looking at companies that produce gas from the Permian gas is still going to continue to trade as a deep discount to Henry Hub gas prices. And the reason why is the pipelines control it, and they're all full. They can't take any more gas, so they're not able to pay the higher prices for it. There's no bidding war for gas price out there with the pipelines.
So, Dan, when you see these higher prices, natural gas prices, and they stick around for a little bit, obviously it makes sense. That's going to run to the bottom line of these companies. What or how do you play it around earnings reports then? Do you, obviously, you're buying kind of before, but what is your strategy when these companies start to report these earnings and actually show the market just how much better they've done?
Well, like about a month later, after our last interview, I started updating all my 25, 26 forecast models, and I'm using $3.25 for the first quarter and $3 for the second quarter. Well, obviously, they're going to get prices way above that. And then I adjust each company for regional differences and for their hedging contracts. But yes, it's going to have a significant increase. I mean, you're talking about a more than 10, 15, 20% increase in their realized gas prices, and they produce a lot of gas. These, Antero, the other, let me give you three more, is Coterra Energy, CTRA, EQT Corp, which is the second largest gas producer in the U.S., and Range Resources, which is RRC. And I like, so Antero, Coterra, Antero, EQT, and Range are all Appalachian companies. Now, they're big enough, and they have long-term marketing contracts with the pipelines, so they can get their gas into the pipelines. Now, they can't ramp up their production much because there are pipeline limitations, but they produce so much gas already that these prices are going to go right to their bottom line, and they look really good. And Antero has none of their gas hedged. So if you really believe in higher gas prices, Antero Resources is your pick, AR.
Well, Dan, just one more question on just the nat gas pricing itself and what these companies could lock in. I remember talking to a lot of other energy people back in the beginning of 2024 when we saw nat gas get down to 150 and then, $2 and hover there. And I said, is it possible by the end of this year that we're at $3 to $4 gas? And a lot of them shot the idea down. No way, we're probably going to be stuck down here forever. Well, sure enough, at the end of last year, we're at $3 to $4 gas. And you were one of the only people we brought on the show that said, yeah, that's totally possible. So I think that you've been hitting it pretty well as far as your nat gas pricing. You said you used $3.25 and then $3 for the first half and second half of next year. Do you think it's possible we go to $4 and stay above it for most of the year, or even hit $5 as a result of the combination of weather, not just the LNG terminals, but also the increase in nat gas and power and electricity generation?
Yes, and that's another thing, AI power generation. And I've heard a lot of people talk about, oh, these small nuclear power plants. Yes, long term, that's the solution. But in the near term, building these modular natural gas fired kind of mini power plants, there are multiple AI data centers, and they're using this company, Solaris Energy Infrastructure, SEI, to build these for them, and they can right size for them. These are, just think of it as a Generex, a giant Generex that you put next to your house, but this one's as big as a freight car, and you can hook them together as many as you need. And here's the thing with these AI companies. Remember, these are multi-billion dollar market cap companies, and they have a lot at stake. Their stock prices are priced to perfection. They will pay whatever it takes to get these power plants set up so they can open these data centers, because they're doomed. I mean, if they can't open these data centers, then they're out of business. So it's going to be, SEI is in a really good position.
Dan, what about internationally then? As much as we talk about how LNG terminals will help spread North American gas around the world, and look, cold weather in the US, yes, that drives the natural gas price. What are some international factors that can drive the natural gas price?
Well, the entire northern hemisphere has been colder than normal this winter. It's been cold in Europe as well. And natural gas prices in Asia and in Europe today are over $14 per MMBTU. So even if you're paying $4 for the gas, it takes another $2.50 to turn it to liquefy it and export it and transport it over to Europe or Asia, you're still getting a giant profit margin. And in fact, who was it? HFI, I think, they did a report on it, said to get to price the LNG exporters out of business so they would stop exporting, you would have to have a gas price of $8 to $10. And probably what would happen is if it went that high, you would also see the prices in Europe and Asia go up. I mean, a couple of years ago when the whole Russia-Ukraine war started, oh, there was $30, $40 an MMBTU prices in Europe, because they were just struggling for supply. And they, because of the cold winter, they are draining their storage, even faster than we are. So it's going to be tight. And I think the international market for U.S. gas and for Canadian gas, isn't Canada's opening up an LNG exporter facility, isn't it? In a couple months, they're going to open that up.
Finally, yes, they're going to get one, but they're very far behind the US.
Yeah. And I also heard that their gas supply is already pretty much spoken for that export facility. People have already contracted for it. So maybe the little guys won't be able to get the gas price in Alberta that we were hoping for or something, but it's going to come up. I mean, and it's been cold in Canada also. So you guys are depleting your storage as well. It'll take time. But I talked to Inplay the other day, and they said they have not yet seen any significant increase in the gas price.
Well, there's also six other, planned natural gas LNG terminals in Canada, most of them all in British Columbia for the most part, and the idea to take it over to Asia. So it's going to be interesting to watch that happen for the Canadian markets. Just one more question on how this ties into maybe oil services. You mentioned some of the pipeline limitations, and some of the companies that have pipelines should be doing pretty well. Any opportunities in the oil services or pipeline companies to cash in on this LNG
Yeah,
trend?
I really like the pipeline companies. The one I think that's the best value right now is Plains All American. Last time I looked at this, the shares were below book value. There's two ways to invest in it. If you're okay with owning a master limited partnership, an MLP, PAA is an MLP, and it pays a slightly higher dividend then it's percentage dividend, then it's general partner. They both pay identical dividends. I mean, always have, always will. The only asset that PAGP, that's Plains All American GP, general partner, PAGP, and it, both of them have dividend yields like, you know, 8.5%, 9%, but they pay identical dividends. It's just that PAGP, because it's not an MLP, trades at a little higher share price.
Okay. Well, then let's now talk about oil quickly, because oil has been on quite the uptrend as well. Started at the tail end of December when oil was stuck right around, let's call it $70 a barrel. Now it's closing in on $80 a barrel, close to some levels that we haven't seen since more in late summer. What is driving this oil price increase in your eyes?
Well, I think it's kind of political at this point. It's a little bit ahead of itself, if you ask me, but I do think the economy seems to be going well. You know, we're not having a global recession or anything. There's some talk about how China's kind of getting it together a little bit over there. But, you know, we're up to $79 plus the WTI, $81 on Brent. I mean, if it stays there, again, my forecast models that I was updating a few weeks ago, I was using $70 for the first quarter and $75 for the second quarter and $80 for the third quarter. So beyond, you know, the second half. So I was expecting us to get back to 80. But now I think I think this is going to happen quickly after he's in office, which is next week, he will slap the sanction and enforce sanctions on Iran like immediately. And if he does, I don't know if he'll go so far as having U.S. Navy blockade their ships. That could send oil to 90 really quick. And I also think he's going to do something about Venezuela. Now, we need the Venezuelan heavy oil. We need the Canadian heavy oil, which is one reason we're not going to put any tariffs on it. But also, I mean, we've had the EIA today reported about a 2 million barrel drop in U.S. crude inventories, which is like the eighth consecutive weekly decline in U.S. crude oil inventories. OECD inventories, which is the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, their petroleum, this is total petroleum inventories, are below normal for this time of year. And if you measure them on days of supply, they're really low based on days of supply. So as long as there's no, you know, recession or depression or whatever in Europe and around the world, inventories are tight. And I think there's this paradigm out there that we have this big glut of oil and OPEC plus can increase, you know, oil exports, you know, just by turning a few taps, and they can't. They can over, you know, months of time. But, you know, if they take a million barrels of Iranian oil off the market, that's going to have an immediate impact on the oil price.
Well, Dan, since it is a global market and you brought up OPEC there, a lot of people are worried that OPEC could increase production. Explain why you think it's not possible, and then also bring into the equation the dynamics between Russian oil. Russia is still a huge producer. They're still getting it circulated via India and other countries, but how do the sanctions play into that factor of the oil markets?
Well, the recent uptick in oil prices is because, and this is the Biden administration, they put sanctions on and started enforcing sanctions on these shipping companies, on the tankers. And so they're telling the ports in some of these places that if you allow these ghost tankers that are, you know, really, you know, bypassing, you know, tracking stuff and everything to get Russian gas to market, we're going to put sanctions on you. So it's tightening up the market. But really, to date, there really hasn't that much Russian oil been taken off the market. I mean, there's been some of these drone attacks that have done minor damage to some of their export facilities and refineries, but that's it. But then another thing is, you know, it's cold in Russia too, and they need their own, you know, they don't export as much heating oil in the winter time. So, I mean, there's a lot of things. And another thing to remember is demand for oil-based products always goes up about 2 million barrels a day from the first quarter to the second quarter, just because, you know, 90% of people live in the Northern Hemisphere and we start driving more. So demand for transportation fuels always goes up about 2 million barrels a day in the second quarter.
So Dan, with Trump coming in, look, we talk a lot about this drill, baby, drill. And I know we've talked to a number of people that said, look, it's just not going to happen because of the fact that these companies are only going to drill if they have higher prices. to take the, I guess, other side of that argument, is there anything Trump can do to lower the costs for these companies so that they could actually start drilling, increase U.S. supply?
Well, you know, most of the increase in supply is going to be coming from the Permian Basin, but it's already pipeline limited. I mean, it doesn't have the export capacity out of the region. You know, you can't truck that much oil out of there, so it's got to go by pipeline. I just don't think there's much that Team Trump can do to increase U.S. oil production in 2025. Now, yes, if they, you know, open up more federal lands for drilling, or if they lower restrictions, and you know, if they really wanted to do, you know, lower the federal tax royalty on offshore oil or something like that, would give them more cash flow. There might be, you know, some political back from that, but you know, U.S. oil production increased about 1 million barrels per day in 2023 because we were still rebounding from the COVID stuff, but we're now back to, we're really just back to slightly above where we were pre-COVID. We're at about 13.2 to 13.5 million barrels per day, but we've only increased U.S. oil production by 300,000 barrels per day in 2024. And I will tell you that IEA, the International Energy Agency based in Paris, France, not Paris, Texas, Paris, France, they're overstating U.S. production growth in 2025. There's no way. I was listening to a webinar. I wasn't on the webinar, but this panel of experts in the market that does a big panel discussion every year in January, they're predicting that the most U.S. production can go up is 300,000 barrels a day. And the guy who I consider is the most expert says he thinks 200,000 barrels per day increase is the most he sees for U.S. production going up, no matter what happens. Now, over time, yeah, technology can do something. You know, we can have horseshoe wells, but there's really no way drill baby drill is going to happen until we have higher prices. And yes, the South Tech, that's another reason why I like Crescent Energy, because South Texas does have excellent pipeline capacity left. So it's a place that could go up. And Central Oklahoma also is a good place that has pipeline capacity left.
Well, Dan, we hear a lot from people projecting higher and higher production from the U.S., and that's obviously what the Trump administration wants. But there's the reality of a lot of these basins are past their peak. With the exception of the Permian, a lot of the basins like the Eagle Ford and some of the other ones are actually in decline. How does that tie in when you talk to companies versus what people are saying, giving lip service to on TV? When you actually talk to the companies, do they have plans to really increase a lot? Because most of the basins are in decline.
You know, the only ones that are really showing big increase in production is because they did a big acquisition. They bought production. So that doesn't increase total production. It increases their production, but it doesn't increase total U.S. production if they just bought somebody. So that doesn't do it. And another thing, and this is something that we've discussed below, before, in the Permian Basin, the gas to oil ratio continues to drift higher. And I follow literally like 20 companies that are in the Permian Basin. All but a couple of them are reporting increasing gas to oil ratios every month. So their BOEs per day are going up, but it's natural gas and natural gas liquids. It's not crude oil. And another thing is this ultralight oil that comes out of the shale is not suited for making a diesel fuel. You need black oil. We need the Canadian oil. We need the Venezuelan oil. We are importing about 6 million barrels a day. And we're exporting, you know, 2 or 3 million barrels a day of ultralight oil. So we have to import black oil so that we can make diesel fuel. And the global oil market is much more complicated than people think. And, you know, it wouldn't matter if we could, you know, double the Permian Basin production. We just have to export it.
Dan, do you think the U.S. at any time, or can we broadly say that the U.S. is running out of oil, or is there still plenty of available oil to be drilled, to be produced throughout the U.S.?
Well, there's plenty of oil, but, you know, you get on a treadmill because we are getting most of our production. I mean, 80% of our production now comes from tight oil shale and other tight formations where they drill horizontal wells. They frack the hell out of them. They come on strong. And because these wells have really high depletion rates, they come on, you know, 1,000 barrels a day, and 6 months later, they're 500 barrels a day. So you have more and more wells depleting, and so you have to just keep drilling more and more new wells to do it. And eventually, you run out of tier one areas. So other than the Permian Basin, all the other areas, the Bakken, you know, Oklahoma, you know, Uinta has some upside. South Texas has some upside, but not much. And they're nothing. I mean, in size, they're just nothing compared to the Permian Basin. So none of them can offset that. So if the Permian peaks, the U.S. peaks. And you may have noticed that Joe Biden, one of his, you know, gifts to Mr. Trump was he just put all of the offshore U.S. off the West Coast and the East Coast off limits, and a third of the Gulf of Mexico off limits for drilling. And this is, he's doing it under an act that's like 53 years old that gives the president the power to do that. And it's not, he's going to have to go through Congress and the Senate, House and the Senate, to get that reversed. So that's not going to happen real quickly. And we definitely need to develop our offshore oil reserves. That's the outside of the Permian, that's the only place that really has significant upside.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what the Trump administration does with offshore drilling. But you did bring up a company that you wanted to review today that is drilling a lot of wells, and they are doing a good job with growth, and that's Kolibri Global Energy, traded on the ticker KGEI. You see some good growth potential here, but really outstanding well results. So give us the value proposition for Kolibri Global Energy.
Well, first of all, Kolibri is a very small company. So even though they are having a percentage increase that's pretty high in their production, we're not talking about making any difference in U.S. oil supply. So, okay, this year, back in November, they announced the completion of three wells from the same pad. They drilled all the wells first. Then they brought in completion crew and they completed them all at the same time. They have really good pipeline export capacity up there. So they were able to connect these wells, and there's ample. They are just southwest of Oklahoma City. They're in what they call the Scoop Play, and they're developing a shallow oil zone called the Caney. And they were getting good wells before. They were doing 1 mile laterals and they were completing a different way. Well, I mean, they actually fired one of their internal engineers, and they, you know, got some experts to come in, and they came up with a new completion method, and they're drilling 1.5 mile long horizontal wells. The lateral section's 1.5 miles long. Now these wells cost about $6.5 million or so to drill, but they're coming on. These three wells all came on at a total for the three put together, 2,800 BOE per day, about 65% crude oil, about 10% NGL, so about 75% is liquids, 25% natural gas. Again, they can sell it all right away. In fact, Exxon markets all their gas and NGLs and gets good prices for it. So these wells came on. Now, that took their production from like 3,000 barrels a day to almost 5,000 barrels a day. So they're exiting 2024 at about 5,000 barrels a day. So significant stair-step production increase. So then yesterday morning, they announced their guidance for 2025. And it was actually a little bit lower. But what they did is that they are basing that on the previous expectations for these wells, what they call the type curve, that the engineers, the reserve engineers, give them a type curve for those wells. So they had previously completed like 32 other Caney wells. And so they're basing their expectations for this year based on what those wells did, not what the three new wells did. And so they're going to drill 1.5 mile laterals, and they're going to drill eight more Caney wells on their own, where they're like 100% owner of them. And then in a part of their Tishkaminga field, it's called, in part of their acres, they have a 17,000 acre block there. But in part of it, Exxon still owns about half the acres. So Exxon came to them and wanted to drill a test well in the southeast corner of their acreage that's in what's called an unproven area. But the Caney formation, they know, is there because Exxon has drilled deeper wells through the Caney. They're producing from the Woodford at a lower zone. And these are really good gas wells. And Exxon owns all the deep rights. There's one more zone called the T-zone below the Caney. But below that, Exxon owns 100% of the Woodford, which is below that, where it's a gassy formation. So it's very positive to me that Exxon wants to drill this well. And Kolibri, I think, is going to be the operator well. They have the majority, like 55%, and Exxon's got 45%. but that they wanted to drill this well, propose this well, is very exciting for me because it would open a whole new area of their field and would prove up that area of the field. So that's a plus. So there's a lot of upside for this company. Now, since their November 12th press release, the stock is up 77%, but it's still trading for about half of my valuation. And I believe that their year-end reserve report, because remember, these three newer wells, they're called the Alice Renee area. That's the name of the pad, the area where they build them. So it's the Alice Renee 1, 2, and 3. And they're still producing really well. I confirmed that yesterday, still producing above the type curve. And they're going to add a lot more proven reserves. And I think, just back of the envelope calculation for me, their net asset value, PV10 net asset value of Calibre stock will be like over $12 a share. And it's trading for like $6 a share today. So I think there's still considerable upside. And this is like all small caps. You know, small caps can take off when you least expect it. It can just be one good well result sometime. But their balance sheet's in really good shape. They're able to fund all of their drilling program with operating cash flow. They don't need to go borrow money or sell any more money. And in fact, they also announced a stock buyback program because they believe their stock is very cheap. And that's a good sign also.
All right, Dan. Always great having you on the show. Again, Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Prospectus Group. Everyone, thanks for tuning in to this weekend show. I hope you all enjoyed our coverage of the markets and wrapping up with the energy sector. Please be sure to go back through our website, kereport.com, or podcast. Just search the KE Report in your podcast player to listen to all of our daily editorials and company updates we release throughout the week. This weekend, we are at a number of conferences in Vancouver. As you're listening to this on Saturday, we will be at the Metals Investment Forum, and then Sunday and Monday at the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference. If you're in town, please be sure to drop us a line, and we are more than happy to meet up with you in and around the conferences and discuss these markets even more in depth. So everyone, again, thanks for listening in this weekend. I hope you all have a great weekend, and I hope to see you at some of these conferences. Dan, thanks for wrapping up the show with us.
Great, thank you.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.